Welcome to Unsupervised Learning, a security, AI, and meaning-focused podcast that looks at how best to thrive as humans in a post-AI world. It combines original ideas, analysis, and mental models to bring not just the news, but why it matters and how to respond. In this standalone sponsored episode, I speak with Ismael Valenzuela. Ismael is the VP of Threat Research and Intelligence at BlackBerry Cylance. We talk about modern threat intelligence, the shifting attention of attackers, how Gen AI can be used for attacks, how defenders are adapting to Gen AI threats, and many other topics. And with that, here's the conversation with Ismael Valenzuela. All right. Hello. Welcome, Ismael, to Unsupervised Learning.
Thank you. Thank you, Daniel, for having me.
Yeah, perfect. So I will have already introduced you. I just want to get a brief sort of overview on yourself and how you got into security and what you do there at BlackBerry.
Sure. So I've been doing, cybersecurity since it was called something different, right? Information security. We didn't call it even cyber back then, but I started to do, cybersecurity-related things back in 98, 99. And I founded a company, a consulting firm doing information security in at the end of 2000, beginning of 2001 in Spain. That's where I come from. I moved here to the States about 10 years ago. But yeah, I've been doing cybersecurity for, I guess, like 24 years. And what I do for BlackBerry is I lead the threat research and intelligence team. So essentially, I lead a team of very smart people that they not only understand, the malware. I like to talk about attackers' weapons more than just like malware. That's just one subset of it. Mm. They understand these attackers' weapons, but they also understand the motivation. They understand the geopolitics around, why attackers are doing something. And that's more like what we call the intelligence piece, right? So we cover all the aspects from the more technical, the reverse engineering, the malware analysis, the, helping to tune our machine learning models. Right? I know that your show is, mostly about that. So we work with the data scientists to make sure that we tune these models for our products, but we also, do research on the threat actors and their motivations.
Yeah, it's very interesting you say that. The name implies that I'm mostly about machine learning. It's actually kind of a play on words. My background is actually almost exactly 24 years in security.
Oh, wow. So about the same time.
Yeah. So it's not, it wasn't originally AI. My whole career has been in security, and then I sort of transitioned into AI. So I think we probably have a lot to talk about there. I think it's the right framing, because I like to think about what are the attackers doing, what techniques are they using, and inside of what context, like global context, like you said, geopolitical context. And that's why I find threat intelligence so fascinating. And yeah, maybe we can sprinkle some AI in there, but not necessarily if it doesn't belong, right? So
that's good to me.
So what would you say the primary things that are happening right now? What are the trends? Like, what are attackers doing? Why are they doing it? Who are these different groups? What does that look like?
Well, I guess if I had to summarize it in just one phrase, it's like the internet is a mess. It's a lot of everything, and there is more of everything on a daily basis. We do these quarterly threat reports that they're very interesting for us specifically, right? And we're thrilled when we see law enforcement agencies, and we even got United Nations and the Senate and a lot of other very important organizations coming to us and saying, we're reading your threat report, and it's very awesome. Like, we have these questions, which it's fascinating, but mm-hmm. we do this primarily for us to understand the trends. And one of the things that we just see regularly is that there is a regular constant increase in the number of unique malware that we see on a per minute, right? So for example, I'm just looking at the last statistics we have. If you look at where we were about a year ago, we were seeing around December 2022 to February 23, 1.5 unique hashes per minute. That's what we see with our telemetry, right? Based on our products. And right now, the last number I have is about 3.7 unique hashes per minute. Targeting, you know, our customers, right? But it's obviously everybody has different visibility, different angles. But this definitely tells you that there's a lot more. There's a lot more of unique malware that's being thrown out there to organizations per minute. What else do we see? I usually say attackers are lazy, right? When something works, why would you change it?
Yeah, absolutely.
In many cases, it's a business for them, right? If we're talking about cybercrime. So we still see a lot of old school stuff, like the phishing attacks, right? With embedded links or embedded PDFs. We're seeing a lot of PDFs again. Like, this thing's coming.
Oh, interesting.
Come and go. Like, we haven't seen PDFs for a long time. Now we're starting to see a lot of PDFs again. And this usually has to do with, you know, maybe some defenses that Microsoft has built into Office lately that, you know, maybe sometime it will be bypassed again, and there will be a resurgence in, you know, maybe macros or other weaponized Office documents. And we also see a clear trend in the use of cross-platform malware. Again, with this premise of attackers are lazy, if I can obtain more return on investment by crafting a piece of malware that will work across different platforms, Windows, Linux, and Mac OS, by using Go or Rust or other cross-platform languages, I'm going to be doing that, right? Because I'm going to be able to reach out to a larger population or get more victims. So this is just like, you know, a brief summary, 50,000 foot overview of some of the things that we see.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, I'm looking at the report. I pulled it up when you mentioned it. Interesting. And you got some breakdown by industry as well. Yeah.
I'm sharing, by the way, some numbers that haven't been, you know, published yet at this time that we're having this conversation, but they'll be published very soon. So,
yeah.
So give you a heads up on that.
Yeah, very cool. What about like origins or types of attackers, like, you know, hacktivist versus like government versus, you know, I don't know, attacker types? Is it like, is it Eastern Europe? Is it Asia? Is it US versus US? Like, those types of things.
That's a good question. And again, like, if you look at this from a global perspective, unbiased perspective, you're going to see that everybody's attacking everybody, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody has motivation. And cyber is just a weapon. It's just the how, right? But this has been doing, if we look at governments, for example, this has been done for many years, in other areas. And it's still, you know, done in other areas. And that's why there's not only like cyber threat intelligence or CTI, but also human intelligence, right? Or open source intelligence and physical threats. And so, but from a CTI perspective, cyber threat intelligence, we have seen, you know, in the past that there was a clear distinction between the so-called APTs, right? The advanced persistent threats, nation states, attacks where the motivation is stealing intellectual property or doing espionage. And then the other world on the other side of the spectrum, right, which is cybercrime. So this is the criminals that are just going after the money, financial gain.
Yep.
And then the hacktivists, right? That's kind of the other group. The people that are just like going to hack into a company and just because, I don't know, you make profit by selling records or music, and that's bad, right? That's evil, something
right.
like that. They want to make a statement, right? A political statement or social statement. These lines are more blurred than ever. One of the reasons of that is because we're more interconnected, right? And everybody has more of a digital presence. And also because these weapons that attackers are using in the past were like hard to craft or it required a lot more skills maybe to do these things. These days, a lot of these are public, right? And there's been a lot of red teaming tools that have been leaked. CobaltStrike is one of the common offenders, right, in that list. But also Metasploit, a bunch of other frameworks that are open, they're available, that people can just like go and modify. Mm. There's a lot of rats. One of the RATs, the remote access tools that we have been discussing in one of our recent reports, is async RAT. And anybody can go online and just look at the source code of a async RAT and then maybe modify it and use it for these nefarious purposes. So that availability of these tools, attackers' weapons, right, makes it a lot more difficult because sometimes you may have an APT, a nation state, using these tools. And it's very hard to attribute exactly who's behind this unless you have more information, you have context, geopolitical context in many cases, and you can understand the motivation, like behind why somebody is doing this.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it's all kind of blurring together. Yeah, I've seen that a lot with a lot of Russian groups where someone is like, oh, APT related or whatever. But really, it's kind of like a cybercrime group, but they are kind of given a little bit of a go-ahead by the government to not come after them because they seem to be doing good things for the country. But it's not a formal relationship. So it's like, are they affiliated? Are they not affiliated? It's hard to say.
Right, you have initial access brokers now, right? You have affiliates, contractors. Like I could be an independent contractor and offering my services, my skills, my time on behalf of different groups. And one day I could be working for a cyber criminal group that has financial gain. The next day I could be working as part of a maybe a nation state or some other type of group. We have also seen, and this is a trend that we're seeing recently, commercial organizations behind some of these espionage campaigns. And large multinationals that might be in the process of a merger or an acquisition. And there's the traditional way of doing a due diligence by looking at the financial health of an organization. There's also like unofficial ways of doing due diligence.
Sure.
And it's interesting. We're seeing some of that. So when I say that the internet is a mess, it really is.
Yeah, interesting. And what are some of the specific techniques or tactics that people are using? It seems like with proliferation of AI, it seems like spear phishing is one of the things that's getting really easy to target specific people, especially if you put in a whole bunch of context information about a particular target. You can really make the email compelling. One of my favorite examples of this is somebody who just has a big ego. I don't know, sometimes happens in security, but you could just be like, hey, I saw your last talk. It was amazing, right? I really agree with your point about this. And I wrote an article about your talk. And I'm going to actually send it on to the New York Times or something. You send that in a phishing email, like you're going to get a lot of security people. And it's one thing to handcraft that email, right? But that's pretty difficult. But what if you have a crawler who could pull all the security people and then pull all the people who've given talks recently? Then you could pull a particular point out of the talk and then craft the email and send it to them. Well, now you can maybe do that at scale, at the level of like a criminal organization or even at the level of like an APT group for like government to target more important people. So I feel like that is one of the use cases that's getting really bad. Are you guys seeing a lot of spear phishing type stuff?
Well, we have seen reports, right, over the last couple of years of specific threat actors. I'm thinking, for example, North Korea, that has been involved in this type of targeting cybersecurity researchers, right? Specifically working for certain companies that may have access to certain information that might be useful for them. But yeah, and we have actually data that supports what you're saying. For example, in our report, the report that we released a few months ago, we do this every quarter, right? But we have seen an increase since last year, coincidentally or not, with the release of ChatGPT and all of these generative AI tools. We have seen a surge in phishing attacks against Japan. And Japan is a very interesting area because we usually see some malware in Japan that we don't see in other places. Again, everything is every region has like their own characteristics, right? But in Japan, we have seen, like, for example, Emotet, some variants that we haven't seen anywhere else, and they come and go. But now with these tools, guess what? Like everybody can speak fluent Japanese, right? And Japanese is not really easy, right? At least for us foreigners. And it's just a very particular region of the world. Now this has opened up the possibility of any threat actor out there to craft really legit looking phishing emails to target this specific area of the world, which is also, you know, a wealthy country with a lot of industries and, mm-hmm. and could be profitable. So yes, the data supports that attackers are using generative AI for these type of purposes.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point that you make. So you've probably seen this conversation a million times in your career because you've been doing this so long. It's like somebody talks about how, you know, you can't hack Linux. Linux is the most secure operating system. Windows is so insecure. And I'm guilty of this. Back, you know, 20 years ago, I used to think I was on the most secure operating system because I only run Linux or I only run whatever. And it's like, actually, if people actually pointed a little bit of the attention that is pointed at Windows for the last 20 years, and they pointed that at Linux, it would be a nightmare. It would be an absolute nightmare. And the reason Windows appears to be so bad because it's so targeted. And so the point that you bring up about Japan is really interesting. It's like, maybe they're very vulnerable to spear phishing, but no one's been able to get the email through because they don't speak Japanese. So now you have an area that's not hardened against these types of attacks, but the door is now open where it was closed for the last 20 years.
It's a window of opportunity, right? And that's one of the key things in the whole impact equation. If we look at risk management, oh, now we're going to put people to sleep now, risk management.
Not me. No, I'll be awake.
but yeah, the impact, right? At the end of the day, it's all about that. You can, so usually say, you can't just like try to protect against everything. You need to define what is the problem you're trying to solve, right? And it can be everything. You cannot protect all of your assets. Mm-hmm. Like in the physical world, you have to assume, okay, you know, some things can go and it's okay. You just, you know, go and replace them, but other things can't, right? Because they have a high value to us.
Yeah.
That's what we need to define. And yeah, Linux, I remember a couple of years ago, we released a paper on Symbiote, which was a Linux implant that we saw targeting organizations in Latin America, especially financial organizations. And it was a very interesting piece of software, right? Of malware, in this case, doing command and control over DNS, etc. We see a lot of web shells, right, on Linux servers, essentially programs that are supposed to run commands, right? Do execution on these boxes. And think about it, like the cloud. What is the cloud made out of, right? Linux boxes.
Yeah, yeah. Mainly.
And we have, everybody has more cloud presence. So absolutely. I had a conversation a few days ago about the importance of looking at these systems. You know, MITRE has a MITRE attack matrix, mm-hmm. for Linux. And if you look at the government agencies, the documents, recommendations from NSA, from CISA, everybody says, you know, you need to look at these systems because they're often overlooked. People do not run endpoint protection on them. And, you know, you trigger memories. I'm probably old, right? But you probably remember this when setting up Linux systems back in the day and all ports were open by default.
Oh, absolutely.
You have to close them like manually.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of implicit trust that sometimes we put into these systems, making assumptions that are not necessarily true.
Yeah. Yeah, I really love that idea of language being a barrier that has stopped attacks from getting through before. And with LLMs opening up translation, so that barrier comes down. What about deepfakes? Are you seeing much around that where it's easier to convince people of things?
Well, it's a natural next step, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember months ago, I was in a close meeting with some government agencies, and the head of this agency was mentioning that they were already seeing these type of deepfakes calls, where they were imitating the voice of somebody and using that to essentially for financial gain, right? The typical business email compromise, but now with voice. And that's what we're seeing on the news right now. Mm-hmm. We're seeing these deepfakes using voice, using video, like jumping on a Zoom call. Oh, it's a CFO calling.
Yeah, I saw that one. That was so crazy.
Exactly. And it's just, again, one more iteration on something that we have known for a long time. You know, same motivation, just the tools are changing. And with the democratization, right, of these tools as they become more available to people out there. These things are gonna just, you know, make the environment, the internet, even a lot more noisier than they are it is today.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you have the issue of like, if you have a whole bunch of AI bots or agents operating and they're taking all these actions against APIs, how do you know if it's a real human on the other side, or if that's automation, or it's AI, or it's an agent of some sort?
That's a good question, and that's actually one of the uses of ML, right? One of the best things that we can use ML for is to create patterns, and by looking at the behavior of the normal behavior of an app, of how, you know, users interact with an application, you would, you know, kind of infer whether that's normal or not, because typically these botnets will behave in a different way. As usual, you know, it's we usually talk about attackers' tools or attackers' weapons, sorry, and I like to talk also about defenders' weapons because, you know, this is at the end of the day, we're talking about technology that can be used for good or for evil, and many times we just focus on the tools itself, but we don't talk that much about strategy, right? Somebody that has been doing this for a long time, I started on the what we call the red side, right? The red teaming.
Yep, same here.
Hackers like doing pen testing and all of that. I'll tell you what, it got boring. It got to some point where it was boring because it was easy to get into organizations.
And you come back to the customer the next year and they haven't fixed anything.
They don't care. Yes, I remember doing a pen test for a water plant in a country in Europe. I'm not going to say more. And I joined, you know, I connected to the network 9 a.m. By noon, I already had local admin on one of the boxes that control the OT environment. Right. So that's it. At that point, you know, you're a consultant. What do? You write the report, take screenshots, do everything. I created my own local admin account right on that box. So I was called 6 months later to come back and do a retest. Guess what? The first thing I checked is that my user, you know, is still there on that box? He's
Oh
still there.
yeah, nice.
6 months later. So that was probably the defining moment for me when I was like, you know what? I need to help these people in a different way. So that's when I moved to the cyber defense side. And I find fascinating to talk about cyber defense strategy because, you know, you cannot fight these people because at the other side of the spectrum, it's not AI, right, or bots. It's people doing this. You cannot fight that with just tools, with just products, right? You need those. You need the weapons, but you also need the strategy, the human brain to and what you're doing and justify why you're doing something and change tactics if needed, right? Like in any sports game, you gotta change tactics if they're not working.
Yeah, interesting you mentioned a water plant. I had an eye-opening assessment as well, assessing a water system for a state. Yeah, really, really interesting. We seem to be brothers. Y también yo hablo español. So,
También, fantástico.
sí.
Podemos seguir en español, si quieres.
See, it won't be very smooth. My vocabulary is bad, but yo puedo. So, what about supply chain attacks? Are you seeing that, or do you have that stuff in your report? Is it one of the things you talk about? Like essentially, it seems to be getting worse and worse. Like the breaches keep happening, and you keep realizing, oh, wait, but their vendors. Oh, but what about their vendors? And it's like, how do you secure the chain all the way down?
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I think we have a paragraph there or a comment on this in the latest report that we're publishing, and we talk about the secure by default approach, right? That the government, especially here in the U.S., with the executive order, they're trying to push for this, right? CISA pushing for this as well, especially with you know, protection of critical infrastructure. So important, but other countries as well, United Kingdom, Canada, EU, the G7, they're all issuing guidelines on this topic of like creating secure software. But here's the thing: are we ever going to fix that problem? No. There's always going to be something, right? Can we do something to fix it and use, you know, for example, programming languages that make better use of memory, so we have less buffer overflows? Yes, absolutely, right? Technology is going to help there. But we're never ever gonna end up creating like 100% secure software, because there's no such a thing in the world, right? There's no 100% secure with anything. But so that's what the laws and regulations are pushing for. In my team, as you know, researchers, what we do is to analyze what we're seeing out there, and what we see is attackers obviously doing the supply chain attacks in the SolarWinds style. These are like very highly targeted attacks that we don't see on a daily basis, right? Mm-hmm. But you also see like pseudo supply chain attacks. What we see is, for example, imagine this small company in, I'm going to pick, I don't know, another region of the world, let's say the Nordics, right? Mm-hmm. Talking about language. So you have, you know, Finnish and Swedish and Danish, and not a lot of people out there in the world speak these languages.
Yeah.
So there is this little company out there that they have this freeware, right? And it's a dictionary of Nordic, you know, terms, mm-hmm. something like that. And a lot of companies that want to do business with the Nordics, they actually download this freeware software. So let's put the bad guy hat on, right? So if I want to target these organizations, what do I do? Very simple. I just either attack this website and replace that freeware dictionary with something else that has an extra piece of code in it, right, to compromise these organizations that are going to be downloading it, mm-hmm. or I try to essentially clone that site, right? Scrape it, clone it, and instead of NordicDictionary.com, it's Nordic/dictionary.com.
Yeah.
Or Nordic-dictionary.com. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be cloning all that, and I'm going to be serving this type of dictionary that has this extra code. We see that a lot. And, you know, through emails, now we get the phishing factor, right? Through any other type of communications. Hey, download this. Use this little thing. Now we're targeting specific location, a specific region. It's not really a supply chain attack as we, you know, think of it, but there's a lot of that happening.
Interesting. And where do you see these attacks sort of going? I guess involving AI or not involving AI. I guess it's probably the biggest switch. So what happens to threat intelligence when both the attacker and the defender are powered with AI? Like, does everything get faster? Like the window for attack and the window for fixing things closes faster? What do you think?
You know, that's a good question. And from a technology perspective, I like to assume that everybody has access to the same, right? It's just a matter of how well you can implement something. Like, we all have access to pretty much the same type of knowledge about technology. The difference is, you know, how fast can you do something, build it or weaponize it, and how effective it is, how well built it is, mm-hmm. and tested, proved. And even if you assume that everybody has the same weapons, right? It's a sum zero kind of a game. The difference is on the tactics and the strategy, right? Mm. The humans behind it. So that's why I think I love to talk about the human in the loop, right? When we talk about AI, the brain, somebody that can, you know, observe what's going on, assisted by these bots or AI, and then make a decision based on that. For a lot of smaller organizations, that will probably require some sort of a third party, a partner, somebody that can help, right, to provide that guidance. But there's never going to be a substitution for the business itself knowing the business. Like, you know your business, mm-hmm. right? A manufacturing plant, they know their business. They know things that nobody else is going to be able to know. So I think that's where the key of this is making security accessible, making intelligence accessible to those making the key decisions.
Mm.
This is not just the SOC analyst, right? Or the incident responder or the threat hunter, which is, you know, probably where at the level that we operate, that we like, right? Because we like technology and the toys and all that. But no, more importantly, it's to making this intelligence accessible to the decision makers, to the C-level executives, so they can understand what's happening, right, in with their business. For example, we do a lot of business in Asia Pacific, and we see manufacturing plants in Taiwan that are being targeted with very specific pieces of malware that have geofencing. So they're only going to execute if they execute within that region, right? In that geolocation, those geocoordinates. So what that means is that it's highly targeted, of course. And who has a vested interest in what's happening in manufacturing plants in Taiwan? Well, you can think of one country, for example, that has extensive operations in terms of espionage in the region.
Yeah.
Well, if you're an executive of a manufacturing company in the U.S. and you want to open up a plant in Taiwan, don't you think that you would like to know that?
Right.
Don't you think that affects your business operations? We have seen threat actors going back to Russia, right? In the past, targeting law firms here in the U.S., looking at mergers and acquisitions and using that information to play the stock exchange.
Mm.
So all of these things have implications in the real world. And I think that's something that I'm particularly, well, I don't want to say obsessed with, but I try to work with. And it's trying to make this type of intelligence more digestible, more strategic, right, for those that are making these type of decisions.
That's interesting. I built the security measurement program over at Apple for a number of years in the past. And that was a big part of I also was in the military. So I was thinking in these same exact terms that you're describing. So I was thinking data, information, and then insights, and then intelligence. And at the very top of that is the decision maker. So I'm trying to figure out what is the most work that I can do for them to enable them to make a decision. So they're not processing logs. They're not even looking at log summaries, which would be like the next level up, but instead they're being told a story. So it's a narrative. So the narrative is something like, this enemy tends to attack between the hours of 2 and 3 a.m., right? They tend to come in a small group of 3 to 4 people wearing dark clothing. They carry light weapons. They don't come on full moon. But tonight is not going to be a full moon. It's actually a new moon, so there's no moon whatsoever. So, therefore, we think it might happen tonight. And here's why we think that, right? So that brings them all the way up to the decision point. And that's my favorite type of threat intelligence, where it gives you data, but it doesn't drown you in the data. It actually does analysis that brings you right up to the point that they can make a decision. So what does that look like for you? I see this report here, which looks quite good, but what else do you have within your philosophy and your product that helps you do that for the decision maker?
Yeah, so when we look at, for example, this report, it's a mix, right? We have some more narrative in the beginning, high-level introduction. As I said before, we have, from people in the Senate to CISOs reading these, to also CTI analysts. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we do is to, do like a high level, executive summary for anybody out there that wants to share these type of things with executives. Just know they're not going to read a lot of things, right? If anything, they may just see a few infographics and one page, right? No more than that. So we try to stick to that rule. And then we go into more statistics. A lot of people, love to see these like trends. This also gives us the opportunity to talk to, media and journalists. So they love the numbers.
Yeah.
And it helps, right, to also identify trends. And then we look at cyber attacks per industry. So, for example, if you are in what we call critical infrastructure, right, and this could be, hospitals. This is manufacturing plants. This is power plants. What are some of the top threats for your industry, right?
Sure.
If you're in health, what do you want to look at? If I'm in healthcare, I don't want to see all these, malware that is targeting financial organizations, for example, because that's not what I may see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also very interesting, talking about trends, what we have seen is that traditional cybercrime against financial organizations tend to reuse the same malware over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Less targeted versus attacks against healthcare and government, local governments. We're not talking about, the large government facilities. In many cases, we're talking about small government, state agencies. or schools even, right? Education.
Yeah.
And we see more highly targeted, right? Because they're going after specific objectives.
Mm.
So that's the idea of this is data that I would like to have to be able to build my threat model.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, something that we like to include, there's the geopolitical analysis and comments. So we have people that are experts in geopolitical analysis, looking at what's going on. Like, for example, a few months ago, December 23, the U.S., Japan, and South Korea, they signed an agreement to defend against North Korea attacks.
Mm.
That's on the news, right? So you see that. How is that going to influence what we're going to be seeing in Asia Pacific over the next few months? Well, there's definitely an impact, right?
Yeah.
So if you're operating, again, you have business in that area, you want to have that type of context and information. And then the rest of the report is more, maybe a little bit more technical. So if you want to learn more about the CVEs that are getting exploited, this is more like the information that a SOC may consume, you know, threat hunters, maybe incident responders at the more tactical level.
Yeah, that makes sense. So looking for like a year or two, do you expect AI advancements to help attackers or defenders more?
Again, very good question. I think that eventually it's going to be a net-net, right, for everybody, for both attackers and defenders. I think the key it's going to be not that much on the technology, but how you use it,
mm-hmm.
when you use it. Right? I love to talk about the factor of time. If you look at an attack chain,
mm-hmm.
some people just, they believe there's always going to be like a cyber bullet, right?
Mm-hmm.
A cybersecurity silver bullet.
Mm-hmm.
That, this is the only thing I have to install, right? Just install this. And sometimes vendors, you know, the marketing could be a bit, you know, confusing and could give you the illusion that if you just do this, you're going to be good. No, it's a lot more complicated than that. That's why you need the human factor. But if you look at an attack chain, you know, we usually say this thing that attackers, they have to be right once, and defenders, we have to be right all the time. Well, if you look at it from an endpoint perspective, then yes, right? And we see attackers that are trying different things. And that's why we try to build, you know, predictive models. And, you know, you had Shil in your show talking mm-hmm. about, you know, the math behind all of this and why these predictive models work. So we have to be right all, every single time and how we do that. But if you look at an attack chain, you step out, you zoom out. As a defender, all I need to do is to detect the presence of the attacker once
mm-hmm.
and to come out, hmm. right? So I have a whole attack chain. I have like all the way from the attacker is, you know, maybe doing some reconnaissance or trying to get some information from my organization to the initial access, which could be email or it could be, you know, some sort of exploitation of a service, all the way to the attacker's objectives, right? Which is what? Either to hold hostage of your environment or mm-hmm. to where the valuable data is. This takes time, right? Sometimes in a targeted attack, it could be days, it could be weeks. So you have multiple opportunities across that attack.
Interesting.
Chain successful. So that's why I say, you know, we don't talk that much about cyber defense strategy. But if you look at it from that perspective, all I need to do is to have the right sensors and the right policy enforcement points in the right places.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to disrupt that activity.
Yeah.
As long as the attacker doesn't get to the final, you know, stage of the attack, those actions and objectives, I can win.
I love that. I've never actually heard that put in a positive light. You're basically inverting the whole thing, saying, yeah, the attacker only has to be right once, but look how many opportunities the defender has to see what they're doing. Because they have to go through this whole chain, and those every point on that chain is an opportunity to detect.
Exactly. And look, it's like the physical world, right? It's not that hard. If I if I'm trying to protect defend my house, right, my home, and I have my valuables, I'm not going to put them like close to the front door where
yeah.
somebody could just smash the door and grab it and quickly leave. If I do that and I get stolen, like, look, it's, you know, shame on me.
Yeah.
I have a really, really poor defensive secure architecture, right? I put my valuables next to the front door or next to a perimeter window.
Yeah.
So what do you do? Like a bank does, right? You have the safe in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And what do? You architect with a lot of preventive mechanisms. Those are walls, right? The access mm-hmm. control systems. And, but you know that in the absence of any detection and response, what's going to happen? Somebody's going to, you know, come with huge drill or explosives, or
mm-hmm.
it's just a matter of time. But if you architect with the right sensors, and you also, in parallel, you add security cameras, right?
Yeah.
Add motion sensors, thermal sensors or vibration sensors, whatever. And you orchestrate all of that in a way that you can have a fast response with the big guys with the big weapons showing up quickly. You're effectively now building a defensible secure architecture that where you have prevention, but also in parallel, you know, sensors for monitoring, for visibility, for detection, and for response. When you combine all of these things, which again is technology plus people and processes,
yep,
then you have a lot more chances to be successful, and all you need is once, right? The attacker
yeah.
will have to commit the perfect crime and to be, you know, right every single time to bypass absolutely everything you have architected with. And that's usually, you know, it usually doesn't happen.
Yeah, I really love that positive spin on it. Like I said, I've never actually heard it put that way. So what about the short term, though? I feel like in the short term that AI attacks are so new with, you know, deep fakes and spear phishing, that the attacker is going to be able to move faster to use all these techniques. But I agree with you that over time it's going to equalize. In fact, because the defender has more context, I think it actually might switch towards the defender maybe later, but it'll mostly equalize. Do you agree that though early on, like the next couple of years, the attacker might have the advantage because they could just move so fast and they don't care about like production readiness?
Yes. And that's typically the case, right? We, on the defender side, we have to now look at how we responsibly use this technology, right? And
yeah.
That may involve like laws, regulations, and that's always like, you know, slow.
Yeah.
Now, in the meantime, there's things that we urge people to do, which is like, you know, to protect themselves with products that are using, you know, the latest and the greatest technology. You know, we all know that defending with signatures is like playing whack-a-mole.
Yep.
But still, we see a lot of companies out there that they feel safe because they have a traditional antivirus just defending with signatures, right? Or,
well, and maybe that's why PDF attacks are coming back, because the malware detection stuff like antivirus, old antivirus, can only hold so many signatures. So as they move through time, they kind of take out the old ones. Maybe they took out some PDF ones. So now the attacker goes back to the PDF ones.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So yes, it's always an arms race, but that's why it's important to raise awareness. That's why it's important to have, that's what we try to do with these reports, right? To communicate, look, this is what's happening. And, you know, these are the tools, and this is the strategy, the tactics that you should be using. And, but yeah, they just assume that attackers, they know, like, you know, the products that are out there and how the majority of people use them. So I'm yeah. always a big proponent of, like, add your own little strategy there, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know that attackers are going to go after your organization and do reconnaissance and scrape your website. Like, add a little decoy somewhere, something that will give you an early warning, something that will help you to get that indicator towards the beginning of that attack chain that can give you an advantage over
yeah.
the adversary, that takes the adversary by surprise. How many times will the adversaries, you know, take us by surprise? How many times can we get them by surprise by doing something that they were not expecting?
Yep.
I think that's an area where we still have to do more. And well, that's what I hope that we are contributing with these type of applications.
No, that's perfect. I think that is a good place to stop. Where can we learn more about what you and your team are doing and your latest research? When is it going to come out, and when can we get a link to that?
Sure. So, of course, the best way to, you know, look at our reports is to go to our website, blackberry.com. We have a section for our threat research, threat center, and it's typically, you know, front in the main page. There's going to be a link to our reports. But also, I'm very active on social media, LinkedIn, X. My handle is About Security. So that's also
Oh, very nice username.
Find. I still don't know how I got that one. But again, like, this is an advantage of being on this field for a long time, right?
Yeah.
About Security. And happy to connect with any of our, the audience here. And, you have a fantastic show. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for coming on. And we'll put all those links in the show notes so people can find them. Thanks a lot.
Excellent. Thank you, Daniel.
Unsupervised Learning is produced and edited by Daniel Miesler on a Neumann U87 AI microphone using Hindenburg. Intro and outro music is by Zombie with a Y. And to get the text and links from this episode, sign up for the newsletter version of the show at danielmiesler.com/newsletter. We'll see you next time. Thank you.